Welcome to Behind the Book. I'm Janie Morris, and it's great to have your company, either for the very first time or if you follow our Behind the Book podcasts, welcome back. Now, at Shiro's Unlimited, we love a good book, and equally, we love to learn more about authors and what they do, their writing processes, and so much more. So that's what we do with Behind the Book. We shine a light and dig a little deeper. Now, my guest today was the youngest woman elected to the Australian Parliament, joining the House of Representatives in 2004 as a Labor minister. She was born in Melbourne. She grew up in Manham on the river in South Australia, moving to Adelaide for her high school years. She's a mum, she's a wife, she's a friend, she's a daughter, she's a businesswoman, and she's now an author. She's the Adelaide Crows first woman number one ticket holder. We're going to talk to her about that a little bit later, being a bit of a footy fan myself. But for now, Kate Ellis, welcome to Behind the Book.
Thank you so much for having me, Janie.
Now, the title, Kate, Sex, Lies and Question Time. Did you come up with that title?
Yes, we went through a long process. There was a list of potential titles, some of which I just deemed a bit too dry and boring, and some of which were too controversial and in your face. And that one was kind of in the middle, but I thought it summarised the contents of the book. And yeah.
Well, it's certainly an attention grabber, that's for sure. Before we get into the book, Kate, let's go back in time a little bit. As I mentioned before, you're born in Melbourne, grew up in South Australia, starting out in Manham on the river as well. What was life like in those early years for Kate Ellis?
I just think I had the dream childhood. I really did. I love Manham. For any of your listeners that are not familiar, it's a pretty small town, but on the Murray River, and small enough that your parents can give you freedom, a sort of freedom I don't think you can have in the city, because everyone knows everyone, and if you misbehave, it's going to get back to them anyway. So my brother and I spent our childhood riding our bikes around, fishing almost daily, getting up to all sorts of mischief, and it was brilliant. It was a beautiful childhood.
So moving from there and coming into the city, that's where you started your secondary education. Now, your mum was a teacher as well. Yeah.
Yes. So, my mum was a teacher my whole life. Yeah.
Oh, and so when you moved to, when you moved into the city and you left that country life and you came into the big smoke of that little country town, Adelaide as well. So when was the time in your life then that politics started to play a role for you, Kate?
I don't really know the answer to that question. I certainly got involved at university in politics. But, I mean, one of the things that I think is quite interesting is, so my father died when I was still in high school, and I grew up, my parents never used to talk about politics, but when I got involved, I remember one of Dad's friends said to me, "Oh, you're so much your father's daughter, aren't you?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" And they said, "He was a diehard Labor man." And I said, "I honestly never knew that." So I think even though it wasn't really spoken about, you do talk about values in your house. And I certainly pick those up, I think, pretty early on. So even though neither my mother nor father were, you know, putting up posters or wearing T-shirts or I guess campaigning, that I think that, you know, my mum was my whole life a primary school teacher and saw the importance of investing in education. My dad was really passionate about workers' rights, and so I guess I picked them up all along. But it was when I got to university that I got more involved, and to my mother's disgust at the time, spent more time as a rabid student politician than I did in any of the lecture theatres most of my time at university. But you know, that was a time of awakening, I guess, for me.
Was politics your chosen path as far as what you were going to do after you left high school, Kate?
So I had a few different ideas. I wanted to be a journalist for a while. I'll never confess that to members of the press gallery, but I wanted to work in foreign affairs. I was really interested in maybe being a diplomat or something along those lines, which, yeah. And then I guess as I got more and more involved in politics, I thought about maybe working in politics, but I never, ever saw myself as a member of parliament. I mean, even probably a year before I was elected, I would never have believed that I would become a member of parliament. I just wanted to help my side and work behind the scenes. But, you know, life happens in strange ways sometimes. And I guess for me, it was kind of suggested that I should stick my hand up and run for the seat of Adelaide. And I scoffed at the idea the first few times it was mentioned. And it was only really, I guess, my stubbornness that I thought, how will I ever throw the newspaper across the room or yell at the television or, you know, go to a rally or a protest if I've given up an opportunity to have an impact and try and bring about change. So I thought, well, this will be an adventure. I'll run. And I don't think anyone thought I was going to win. So it was more, I guess, a bit of an experience. But election night, we saw there were some surprising results come through, including for little old me in the seat of Adelaide.
And that was in 2004, and you were the youngest woman at the time elected into the House of Representatives. When you realised that night, on election night, that you had won that seat, what did you think? What were your thoughts at that time? Can you recall?
I remember arriving at my campaign party, and all of these people just standing up and applauding. And I was genuinely shocked because I was devastated. We'd just had a devastating election result for Labor, and we'd just about been wiped down across the country. And, you know, my reason for running was I wanted to help change the government. And so realising that that hadn't happened, I was genuinely devastated that night. And it wasn't until... Well, we didn't even have a final result for several days later, but it took a while for that to sink in and for me to realise that whilst the result had been the opposite of what I was hoping for nationally, that I did have a chance to try and bring about change, and that that was an amazing opportunity, although I was pretty daunted.
So let's lead that into your book, because that's pretty much where your book starts. Sex, Lies and Question Time, as we've already mentioned, is the title. I don't know how many times that my team have said that title in the last 2 weeks leading up to today and dissecting, you know, what the book's all about and going through it. So let's do that now, Kate. And I have to say I've read it 3 times.
Wow.
I've had to read it for the second time I had to read it is I'm a bit of a speed reader, so I miss things. The second time I've picked up some of those things that I'd missed before. And the third time it's been in the last 2 days and I picked up even more. So for anybody who hasn't got the book yet, you're probably going to need to read it a couple of times because it is quite revealing. It's come out at a specific time when not just with the Me Too movement in the last few years, but certainly here in Australia with the March for Justice movement and Brittany Higgins and so on and so forth. When you wrote the book, let's just talk about the timing on that one so we get a bit clear on this. Did you intend to bring it out at the same, you know, now when... how did that happen, Kate?
I don't think anyone could have anticipated what's happened with the women's movement here in Australia this year, or what's happened with the focus on the culture in Parliament House this year. So I didn't know that I was going to put myself at the eye of the storm, releasing this book just a few weeks after Brittany Higgins had so bravely come forward, and of course the allegations had been made against Christian Porter. So when I started writing the book was at the beginning of last year. And at the time, I think you can probably pick up in the introduction, I was really justifying why I'd chosen to tell some of the negative sides of the experience of being a woman in Parliament House, because at that time I thought it might be quite controversial to suggest that there was a cultural problem when it came to women in Parliament House. And of course, by the time the book was released, everyone had just learnt well and truly that that was indeed the case, and it wasn't really news to anyone in the way that I thought it might have been when I was writing the book. So the timing was really interesting, because it came out and so many people said to me, oh, your timing is perfect. But actually I felt a real sense of guilt when people said that, because, you know, in my book I focused on the experiences that I knew about, and that is that of elected women in the building, and some of whom have been the most powerful women ever elected in Parliament, not on the staff, who of course have seen in a much more devastating way the impacts of the culture within that building. So I felt a bit torn about that, and quite guilty about it as well.
I think one of the, in the beginning of the book, Kate, if I can just quote you here, you've said, I want to see more women in politics, and I also want politics to be better for them. I suspect many women in Parliament would say it's a tough job and it's not everyone's cup of tea, but we will just get on with it. That is exactly what I would have said a few years ago. You become acclimatized to it. I now think differently. I've seen how much the culture in Parliament is behind the rest of society. It's outdated, toxic, and often unfair, particularly for women. Because as you've just said, you started writing this at the beginning of last year. You really are the first woman to actually put your hand up and call it out, aren't you, with that?
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, there've certainly been incidents that have been called out, whether that be, you know, Sarah Hanson-Young calling it out, Emma Hussar continuing to call it out. But I guess more broadly, I didn't want to focus on one experience or one person. I wanted to have a look and try and establish that this was a broader problem, and that it was really common, and that it happened regularly across the Parliament, that women were treated in an atmosphere of disrespect, and show that that is a cultural problem. It's not a one-off. It's not about one bad apple. I think it's about the culture of the place, and that really needs to change.
So when you first walked into Canberra, and first on your very first week then, bearing what we've just said in mind as well, were you prepared for what happened, where the focus was not on the fact that you were the youngest woman, but on what you were wearing? And how that would potentially play out for you moving forward in your role?
I think yes and no. I mean, I'd seen it happen before. I'd seen Natasha Stott-Despoja be elected a few years earlier. So I'd seen this happen before, but perhaps naively I thought that I could learn from those lessons and do things differently and avoid that sort of scrutiny. And that proved not to be the case. What I found very soon was that it didn't matter what you did, it didn't matter what you wore, it didn't matter how much you tried to fit in. There was always a focus on particularly physical appearance. And funnily, just in the last couple of weeks, I came across some newspaper clippings. But I saw one from when I was a candidate, and it kind of took my breath away, because I'd run against Trish Worth, who had been a sitting member. So it was a woman v woman battle. And I saw this article where they'd put pictures of us next to each other, and then they'd written an article about how she was trying to reclaim her youth by using old core flutes so that she didn't look like there was such a contrast. And I just can't imagine ever in a male versus male battle of politicians a newspaper, putting photos of them side by side, comparing and contrasting and focusing, you know, solely on their different looks. But that happened in that case. It was Trish who was on the receiving end of it. But yeah, it was pretty constant.
With throughout the book, you've interviewed many other female politicians and got their views on various things and in each of your chapters. Were you surprised with some of the revelations that were coming out?
I was really surprised. So I mentioned Sarah Hanson-Young. I was really surprised when I sat down with her and learnt the extent of the kind of sexualized bullying that she'd been dealing with constantly, not just over days or weeks, but over months in the Senate. And I was shocked by that, and shocked by, I guess, her honesty in talking about the impact that that had on her was really interesting. I found Natasha Stott Despoja's speaking with her, it horrified me, some of the experiences that she'd had just a few years earlier. So I think it's interesting, because when you're all in the parliament and you're all busy focused on your job and you're focused on the battles ahead and you're focused on your political differences, you probably don't see the human side of what's happening to women across the board as much. And so having the chance to see that and speak to women from all different political parties was, it was actually a real privilege to get that kind of access and have people be so frank and honest, because it meant that we could establish a whole lot of similarities, which I hadn't really appreciated how much that existed before.
In getting that cooperation from them, and particularly Sarah Hanson-Young and Natasha Stott Despoja, who some of us know that you have a really great relationship with, because my understanding is she was a great mentor for you, especially in your early years. Let's talk about one of your chapters then, the sisterhood. Mm. You know, there's often a lot of conversation and debate in women's groups and in general conversations regarding the female community, of whether there is such a thing as the sisterhood. You know, sometimes we get the tall poppy syndrome coming in when one woman actually achieves their goals and then everybody else decides to cut them at the roots as well. Is there a sisterhood in Parliament, and is that something that you experienced or not?
I was really lucky in that there is no doubt that I think we grew a critical mass of women in my party in the time that I was there, and the support that that provided was really important to me, but it also brought about changes in what was acceptable and what wasn't acceptable. So it's funny, because the sisterhood was actually the hardest chapter of the book to write. It was so hard because it's really complex, women's relationships with other women in the parliament. And I knew that there's a whole lot of women outside of parliament who just want someone to say, the women are going to stick together and we're going to put an end to all of this. I think my publisher wanted me to say that, but it actually wasn't the reality of the way that the parliament operates. The way that women's relationships in the parliament operate mean that often it's the women who are sent to war with each other, with the women on the other side of politics. They're sent in to do the dirty work. And what I also found is that, particularly in the minor parties, women said that they were actually set up to compete with other women, not to support other women. So there's a whole range of, I guess, things that complicated the relationship and mean that many women think that there is more that separates them from the women on the other side than the shared experiences of being women and the sisterhood. And I think it's one of my favourite quotes in the book, where Tanya Plibersek actually says of the prospect of women getting together and supporting each other more. You know, she kind of says something like, these are the women who are trying to suck up to Pauline Hanson on family law reform, to dismantle the family court, to defund women's shelters. She said, what are we going to do? Catch up and braid each other's hair and talk about boys? And I just thought that that kind of captures that. You know, there are people go into politics not to make friends, but to fight for things that we believe in. And when what you believe in is diametrically opposed to what women opposite believe in, then sometimes that fight is more important than the support that you could provide each other. It's complicated.
With your book, reading through it and on the third read, as I mentioned,
you know it better than I do.
Oh, I've got lots of notes. But, you know, Kate, with your book, when you started to write this, what was your hope for what this book was going to achieve?
I think I started off that I wanted to, in some ways, provide a bit of a guide or advice to women who go into Parliament. And I think where I started was that women can learn from the experiences of those of us that came before them and don't have to, you know, learn all these lessons the hard way like some of us did. And so to shine a light on that would be helpful for other women, or would hopefully even bring about a change in some of those practices and cultures. That's where I started. The more that I went on, the more I realised that I wanted something bigger than that, and that is actually to shine a light on the culture of Parliament House and how that affects the community more broadly. I look at what's been happening this year, and I think that Parliament House is the place that is meant to be leading the nation. It's meant to be best practice. It's meant to be, you know, setting the laws and showing the way for the rest of Australia, and it's not. And that means that the decisions that are made there on what programs to fund, on what goes into the budget, what doesn't go into the budget, on what portfolios are given priority, they affect all Australians. And those decisions are being made in a culture that disrespects women at the moment. And so I thought that was kind of the bigger point, and the point that I really hope to get across, that it needs to change, not just for women MPs, but actually for the country. We deserve a better parliament.
When you, in one of your chapters where you talk about when you made the decision it was time to go, were you surprised at, once the announcement was made, and you've explained beautifully in there how, and by the way, I think this was magic, that you made the choice to write a personal letter to everybody in the community that you represented first and advise them and let them know. I think that was brilliant. You know, congratulations to the heart of you for that. That was wonderful to read. But were you surprised at the social media backlash that started to come out? You've quoted a few of them of people coming out and being negative about what you were doing. I'll just quote one where it says, I'm seething with anger. The painful truth is that motherhood and politics don't mix. That came from one person at News Corp. Were you surprised at that, Kate?
I think I was a bit surprised that I tried so hard to avoid that. I tried so hard. You know, the last thing I wanted to do was send a message that discouraged women from going into politics. So I tried to make sure that I was really personal in my explanation. I explained why it didn't work for me, why it didn't work for my family. And when I made the announcement, I pointed out some of the brilliant mums and dads who have made it work across the parliament and make it work every day and have done for years. But, you know, my announcement, I guess it's an easy, you know, take or an easy news story, was portrayed as proving that you can't be a mum of young kids and a member of parliament. And I was just mortified by that, because it's against everything that I believe or that I've tried to establish.
I find it quite surprising that when you did make that announcement and you retired in 2019, so you'd actually given of yourself for 15 years into the political arena of Australian government, that achievement in itself couldn't have been, you know, shone a light on in that moment when you said, but now I'm retiring. Well, I've actually invested 15 years. So yeah, it's interesting how there was a different sort of take on that. But you've highlighted that beautifully. Thank you
I do kind of understand it from the other side. You know, I understand that women fought for generations to have the right not just to vote but to run for parliament. Mm. And so to have me stand up and say, yes, I'm in parliament, but actually I don't want to be anymore. I want to be at home with my children, or at least in Adelaide with my children. I understand how that was seemed like a slap in the face to some people. It may have seemed that I was ungrateful for the opportunities which people had fought so hard for. So I do get that. I'm just lucky that I was in the privileged position that I got to make a choice that was right for me.
In the chapter of why it's worth it, and I think that this is a great way to bring about the end of our discussion today, Kate, you say the truth is, despite the focus on conflict and division, at its very heart, politics is about positivity. Do you think, looking at the way that politics has been, in particular this year, do you think that there is hope in the future that we get some transparency and accountability and humanity back into politics?
I do. I'm an optimist, Janie. I do. I think that politics has got to be about, you know, having a vision for how we make the country better and then going and getting to deliver it. Like, that is an amazing thing and a positive thing and something that helps people. But I do think we have to find a way to change our politics, that it's just become too much of a focus on the politics, on the sport and the game of it. It's like a sport for nerds, or a sport for people without, you know, any physical abilities to play traditional sports. And the focus has been on the game of politics as opposed to the policies and the outcomes. And we need to find a way to change that. And that means changing the way the parliament works, but it would also mean the media coming on board and recognising there needs to be a change. And I think that's only going to be driven from the outside by the Australian people saying, we want better than this. But I think we'll get to that point.
You've dedicated this book to Sophie, Charlotte and Miller. And you say in the beginning, to Sophie, Charlotte and Miller and their generation of girls who are going to run the world. What advice, Kate, would you give to any of our female listeners who are thinking, well, jeepers, I was thinking of going into politics, but based on the last 12 months, I don't think I would. What advice would you give them, and why did you make that dedication?
The advice that I would give them is absolutely go for it. We need people to step up to make it better. We need women to step up to make it better. And I think the Australian public is ready to support a new generation and a new style of members of parliament. So I would absolutely encourage them to do it. I guess that dedication came from, I was worried you were going to make me cry when you were reading that, actually, that I'm so inspired by this generation of young women that are coming through. And those three young women that I'm lucky enough to know well in my life, my stepdaughter, my niece and my goddaughter. But we've all got them. And, you know, even in the last few days, seeing the girls at Adelaide High School organising a walkout to stand up against sexism, like, I find it so inspiring seeing, you know, young women like Grace Tame, like Brittany Higgins. But I'm so excited about the next generation of women. And I guess I wanted to dedicate this book because I want to do everything that I can to try and clear their pathway and make it easier for them to move on, get elevated and change the nation, change the world for the better. So I was focused on that because I think that's going to happen. I think we've just got this extraordinary generation of women who are about to come and take over the world, and I can't wait to watch it.
So if you had an 8-year-old Kate sitting in front of you right now, what advice would you give her?
Well, I'd probably give the advice to back herself, to back herself better, and, you know, to not get drawn down by other people's criticisms and expectations, because that's the way the system is set up, to try and drag people's confidence down, to try and make you feel like you don't belong in positions of power. And I really wish that I had realised sooner to just take it and run with it, and and not doubt myself as much as I did for a large part of my career. And I hope that the next generation won't waste any time.
The title of the book, as we've already said, is Sex, Lies and Question Time. It's an absolute cracker of a book. It delves into, as we've already mentioned, Kate has drawn on the discussions and conversations that she's been fortunate enough to have with many other female politicians here in Australia. It's an excellent read. It's a great guide, not just for women, but also for men. And we're just so grateful that you had some time for us today, Kate. Thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you all the very best. What's next for Kate? What's the next book?
That is the million-dollar question. I wouldn't hold my breath on another book, I think, but we'll see what the next project is. I don't know. That's something I'm increasingly turning my attention to. So we'll see what we come up with. But, no, thank you not just for having me today, but for reading my book and taking the time to read my book three times even. The one thing that has changed in me since this book was released is every time I look at the pile of books in my room that I keep buying but never find the time to read, whenever anyone says that they read my book, I'm just so amazingly grateful because I know how busy everyone is, and it's really nice of people to give their time to read the books and the chapters that I put together. So thank you, Janie, for reading it three times. You're the winner.
Well, you're more than welcome, Kate, and thank you for taking the time to write it and also to spend some time with us today, and we look forward to keeping in touch with you and seeing what the next, pardon the pun, chapter is for Kate Oz. Kate Oz, thank you so much for joining us, and if you've enjoyed listening to this podcast of Behind the Book as much as I've enjoyed bringing it to you, comment below, share it and like it, and don't forget to subscribe as well. All you need to do is go to shirosunlimited.com and subscribe there so you never miss an episode. And if you haven't already got a copy of Sex, Lies and Question Time by author Kate Ellis, first question, why not? Second solution to that is, again, go to shirosunlimited.com, go to our shop, into the books, and you'll see it right there. Click on there and it will be in the post straight away for you as soon as you do that. My name's Janie Morris. This has been Behind the Book, and we look forward to having your company on our next episode. In the meantime, create an absolutely fabulous day.